It's time for The Outspoken Cyclist, your weekly conversation about bicycles, cyclists, trails, travel, advocacy, the bike industry, and much, much more. You can subscribe to our weekly podcast at OutspokenCyclist.com or through your favorite podcatching app to listen anytime. Now here's your host, Diane Jenks.
And welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. Thanks for tuning in today. Sometimes I wonder how I ever became so lucky as to be able to have conversations with the people I do, and this episode of the show highlights two of those people. First up is Jennifer Boyd. Jennifer is the founder of Boyd Productions, LLC, a documentary production company that prides itself on creating films that spark curiosity, connectivity, and societal change. Her multilingual, female-led team has more than 20 years of experience in filmmaking, in music, television, and journalism. Jennifer has produced and directed more than 25 documentaries on topics ranging from climate change to gun control, and Good Morning America has called her work groundbreaking. The doc, as she calls it, that we're going to talk about is The Street Project. The production is fascinating, the content is relevant, and several of the people who are included in this film have been on the Outspoken Cyclist podcast in the past. Jennifer will be with me in a moment. After our break, we're going to check back in with custom frame builder Dave Wages, owner of Ellis Cycles in Wisconsin. With the closing of Waterford Precision at the end of June, I wanted to get Dave's perspective on what Waterford represented and how he sees the custom business going forward. You may remember that Dave cut his frame building teeth with Cerata and Waterford, and now both of those companies are gone. Dave will be with me in the second half of the show. So The Street Project is a story about a massive movement across the world to reclaim our largest public spaces, namely our streets. The film starts in New York City and looks at the issues of safety and the usage of space across the globe. With more than 40,000 cyclists or pedestrians killed across the world last year, Jennifer Boyd gives us a thorough examination of how the way we've used our public spaces and what has changed throughout the last 10 decades. Hi, Jennifer. Welcome to The Outspoken Cyclist. Thanks for joining me and being my guest today. How are you?
Hi, Diane. It is such an honor to be on the show. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, I love your work. And I think it was your publicist who sent it to me. And I looked at it and I'm like, yeah. And then I watched your documentary and I'm like, okay, I need to talk to this lady. So before we get into The Street Project, which unto itself is just, it's just amazing. I'm going to encourage people to see it. And I know that you're like screening it in a variety of places. Tell me a little bit about you and your background and how this became a project for you.
I guess I accidentally fell into the world of transportation safety. It was really almost a decade ago, I started doing some work on team driving. And it was really before people had cell phones and could take pictures anywhere they wanted to or capture video anywhere. And I thought it would be an interesting idea to put cameras into the cars of newly licensed drivers and monitor their behavior. And that became something much bigger than I ever imagined. So it was called Teens Behind the Wheel and distributed through PBS. And then after that, we decided to, you know, I thought I was sort of done looking at that topic. And eventually somebody came up to me and said, hey, you know, cell phones weren't even invented when you, you know, people weren't even using cell phones back then when you did that piece. Why don't you do something on, you know, texting and driving? Anyway, I thought, all right, well, this could be really interesting. we ended up in this documentary called 3 Seconds Behind the Wheel. And that looked at all the different ways that people get distracted. And by then, technology had come along that allowed us, we were with Google and with MIT, and people used apps and in-car cameras, and it was much more sophisticated. And it turns out that people get distracted a whole bunch of different ways, and it's not just their phones. And so it was kind of this crazy thing. That came out in 2018. And I thought, well, because half of all of fatalities surrounding the car worldwide happen outside of the car or with people who aren't the driver. So I thought, well, maybe a natural second part really would be to not just look, to not look at the driver, but to look at what's happening around the car. And I thought, well, this, I'm going to get to do another human study project. So I'm going to study how people who are cyclists and pedestrians behave on the street. And I even had hours of footage from the New York City DOT. I worked with them and their security cameras. But really, soon into the project, when I was really doing the research on it, I realized, wait a minute, this has nothing to do with distracted cyclists and distracted pedestrians. And it has everything to do with everything you and I'm sure a lot of your listeners already know about, but I was new to the topic, things like road design, things like the way a car is designed, things like speed. And so then this world started to open up. And I started exploring all the different avenues and how we talk about pedestrians and pedestrian shaming and all of that stuff. And I, the film just started moving in all these different directions, and then COVID hit. And then I stopped production for a whole bunch of like 2 years. And then after that, the way we think about streets changed. So then we morphed into something very different again, where it was, wait a minute, we can rethink our streets. People are doing it all over the country and world right now. They're eating outside. They're walking outside on the streets. And so finally, when we were back into production, and we can keep talking about it, but finally, when we were back into production, we realized, wait a minute, there's a whole nother world here about how people gather in democratic streets and streets, not just for cars, but for all of us to use as a community. And again, I know it's probably a lot of things that your audience knows, but my goal was, because I was an outsider, is to now take all the other outsiders and bring them on in and keep them interested. And hopefully we kind of all learned something along the journey.
So let me reintroduce you, and then we're going to delve into the actual documentary. We're speaking with Jennifer Boyd. She is the producer, director, and grand poobah of The Street Project. And we'll tell you how you can find a way to watch it. It's, I think, as I remember, about 52 minutes. It's beautifully put together. And that's, I want to know some of the kind of nuts and bolts of how you did it. But before we do that, I hear what your motivation is. And there's a lot of concern. We're looking at 40,000 people being killed worldwide, I think, something like that, as a pedestrian or a cyclist. And I just learned, actually, not even 5 minutes before you and I began talking today, that one of our friends was riding his bike and a kid leaned out of a car and shot him with an air gun and shot him in the side. And I'm like, okay, this has to stop. So that's where I want to end up when we're done talking, is what's going to happen next. But let's go back and talk about things like safe streets and Vision Zero and people commuting and how you put this documentary together. It's just remarkable, some of your footage. Where did you get some of the old footage that you see? And we're talking about going back probably to the 1920s.
Yeah, I actually, well, in my other life, I do a lot of history docs. So There are a lot of great resources out there through Internet Archive, through the stock footage houses, through the Library of Congress. So, you know, truthfully, with the power of Google, it is not hard to find that footage. It just takes some time and it is out there. Some of it is just, you know, old, you know, commercials or from the automobile industry or just B-roll that was out there, public service announcements, that kind of thing. So it's really, you know, there's a whole system out there for finding that footage and licensing it. It's not free.
Right. You do mention the automobile industry, and I know I've spoken about this before. I can't remember with whom I had this conversation. Fill us in a little bit on what the automobile industry, including the AAA, did to begin to sort of denigrate cyclists and especially pedestrians. The whole jaywalking thing was just mind-blowing if you delve into it a little bit.
Yeah, that's a really interesting part of, you know, what we discovered, but I know a lot of people may have known this, the term jaywalking or a jay, was a very sort of negative Midwestern term. And, you know, there was this PR campaign that was launched and, you know, some of it initially, people were walking the streets, cars were going fast, the whole dynamics of the streets were changing as the advent of the automobile came into existence. And people were getting run over. But Peter Norton really is an expert and talks to this so eloquently. There ended up being, you know, these campaigns that encouraged people to stay out of the street, to use encouraging them to think about streets as for cars. And I do have to say, you know, we continue to do that today, because it seems like we want to embrace the newest and latest and greatest thing that keeps us feeling young, you know, being modern, whatever it is. And back then, the car was modern. It was convenient. It was sophisticated. It was all of the things that, you know, quite frankly, you know, we continue to love about the car. So, you know, we tend to like the best, the latest and the greatest. And it was no different then. And the latest and the greatest was the automobile. So it was easy to understand how that message of walking out in the street, which was something that was so common before cars were popular, that message of this new term of jaywalking, being out in the street in our largest public spaces, was a bad thing, and that you, the pedestrian, were the fool for being out there, because we all should embrace the newest, latest, greatest, most modern thing.
And out of that, we began building suburbs and we began moving people farther and further from the things they needed to get to: groceries, dry cleaners, doctors. You had to get into a car. We are now paying the price for that. Right. If you just look at your weather forecast, you know, I think we're seeing that now.
And Jeff Speck does a really great job of talking about that in the doc and in his work, of which again was something that I never really thought about, of how we all compartmentalized our lives and our communities. So the soccer fields are all in one place and the grocery stores are in another and the schools are in another and churches are in another and the cul-de-sacs and residential areas are in another. And it really looks wonderful on paper. It's, you've got these very neat and organized spaces within a community. But what we forgot was how lovely communities functioned when you could walk down the street to grab something quickly at the grocery store, or you could easily walk the kids to school, or you could go to the baseball field down the street. There was, and we see that in older cities in the United States, and we certainly see it around Europe, where that convenience of being able to quickly go somewhere without having to get into the car, you know, is something that we did lose in a lot of newer communities.
So a lot of people think that we should be modeling our communities or our cities on places like Amsterdam and Copenhagen, which is in some ways unrealistic until other things change. You know, right. We have to change our thinking in a whole different way. So right. What are some of the things that came up in your documentary are things that simple things that people did. And I did not get the name of the wonderful woman who was the focus of the documentary, who rides her bike to work. She's so cute.
Yeah, Dulcie. Yeah, Dulcie is great.
And she's in New York. That's in the Bronx,
Brooklyn.
Maybe?
Oh, Brooklyn. Yeah. Brooklyn. Okay. And, you know, I do have to say, I'm glad you brought up Copenhagen, because there's a lot of experts out there, folks that, you know, would say, oh, yeah, of course, a cycling documentary that talks about Copenhagen, because it's like the exception to the rule of, yeah, everybody's biking. And I wasn't going to cover it because of that. I had all these other cities that were planned before COVID, and then it was canceled. And then that gave me more time to do more research. And as I was studying, I realized, wait a minute, Copenhagen wasn't always like this. It was a city that, in fact, was embracing the car, that they were ripping up bicycle and pedestrian pathways and straightening streets for the benefit of the car. And that because of economic reasons in the 50s, 60s, 70s, they nearly went bankrupt. They ended up having to spend money in different ways. They couldn't afford fuel. And it's hard to imagine now because their quality of life and economic standing is so high. And so then I thought, wait a minute, now there's the story. This was a city, a major city, that had embraced the car, realized that they couldn't afford to keep embracing the car, and that they needed to look at other kinds of transportation. And so, you know, the cycling infrastructure came back because it was cheaper to build the cycling infrastructure. And I think often we think that it's more expensive to have cycling infrastructure. And so communities think they can't really afford it. And so that's really, it's kind of this entertaining light little story in the middle of the doc, but I just so love it because there's so many messages that I think Americans can take to heart and communities, small and large, can take to heart here.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that when you look at dollar for dollar building infrastructure and jobs, bicycle and pedestrian infrastructure is so much less expensive than miles and miles of concrete for bridges and roads. And, you know, I'm watching some things change in our community here and just shaking my head. I mean, they're building these beautiful crosswalks right now. They look like brick, but they're not. I mean, but it's this new thing that they're doing at all these crosswalks. And I'm wondering why, because the cars are still going way too fast. They're not narrowing the lanes coming into those intersections. They're not putting up more trees. So, it's like, I'm not sure what they're doing at this point.
No, you know, and I feel for you. I struggle with this in my own community in Connecticut, where it truly is. It has great bones. It's a very walkable community. And we struggle every day to try to incorporate bike lanes and, God forbid, protected bike lanes on these streets. And people, you know, they complain about parking downtown. We need more parking. We can't fit the people that want to come to the restaurants. But they don't seem to believe that if people felt safe cycling, more people would cycle downtown because they don't want to deal with having to pay for parking downtown or try to find a spot. And we live in a very dense area but it's so hard to get people to think about other ways of doing things, right? Because streets have been really efficient ways of getting people through towns. But do we really want them to zip through town, or do we want them to stop or drive slower and maybe happen to look at the stores around them and say, hey, oh, maybe I do want to stop and visit a store?
Yeah, that's a whole nother conversation about the economic impact of slowing people down so that they do frequent the restaurants and the dress shop and the barber shop and whatever else is in the little center of town. So I actually have a question about the technical part of the documentary, because again, it's so beautiful. Two things, and you can say, I don't want to talk about that, and I'll cut it out.
No.
How did you fund it?
Actually, so Travelers Insurance has been a big funder of mine for many years. I think they funded at least seven of my documentaries, which was sort of a motivation for doing some of the transportation stuff. It was issues that they cared about, but, you know, they weren't involved in the editorial content at all. They just, their foundation gave the initial funding and helped, in that way. And then they just kind of leave you alone, because that's the way the PBS works. World works, and I'm forever grateful for that. And then 3M came in later, and they added some funding to this particular project, and then General Motors. And General Motors, initially General Motors was a funding of my previous doc, 3 Seconds Behind the Wheel, where we looked at distracted driving, right? And so that was they really liked the concept, and they helped support it, you know, very nicely. And so when I said I was going to look at distraction outside of the car and how that impacted fatalities, they were like, sure, yeah, we'll fund, we'll provide a grant. And like I said, within a few months of real research, I realized it had nothing to do with distraction and everything to do with a whole bunch of other issues.
Right.
But again, you know, I had to be honest to what the story really was. And with this sort of documentary model that is truly authentic, there is a real separation between funder and content. So I couldn't continue and, you know, lie that it's about pedestrians staring at their phones and walking into the street, because that is statistically insignificant. We know that humans understand that if they step in front of a car, they don't have a fighting chance, because the car is actually bigger than them. So it was, you know, so I had to be true to the topic, and that's where we are today.
So that brings up a question that never occurred to me. First of all, I didn't realize what the funding was. I guess I should have studied the credits more. And I did. And I was so excited about seeing the beautiful, you know, the way the documentary was put together. But could that be an incentive for a company like General Motors or 3M or even Travelers to look at their role in the automobile and how they could also be involved in changing their role and changing our thinking to make people safer? I mean, you know, maybe it's e-bikes, maybe it's, you know, electric cars, maybe it's selling cars that have governors on them, you know, that if you're going to have a car that you only use in the city, it's going to go 25 miles an hour. Those are silly ideas, but.
No. And there's a lot to that, but it's kind of, one day I just sort of woke up thinking, wait a minute, why do we allow vehicles to be created and sold in the United States that drive far faster than any legal speed limit in the country? Like, why is that allowed? Like, but, you know, that's a whole different issue. So, you know, obviously, this is a very complex topic. And I'm sure all three companies would tell you that they are doing things that address safety issues and concerns in a multitude of different angles. I don't have the answer to specifically what they are doing, but, you know, we're all talking about this a lot. I wish there weren't a lot of blunt-nosed gigantic cars on the road? Yeah, right. It's terrifying. I even have a friend in Michigan who was just rear-ended by a massive, commuter truck, let's call it, like a just like right into her tiny car, and she flew into the air and is now, it'll be 2 years of trying to get better. Anyway, so that's, we all, you know, cars are bigger, cars are faster, cars are designed in ways that aren't very pedestrian or cycling friendly right now. And that does terrify me and a lot of people out there, right?
Absolutely. Who do you want to see this documentary? Who needs to see it? And how are you going to distribute it in a way? I mean, I'm lucky. I'm in that unique journalist position that people come to me and go, this is an interesting story. Would you like to cover it? And I'm like, well, hell yeah.
Yeah.
And then my listeners get to hear it. But that's, it's not as big as it sounds. You know, it's a small niche.
So the beauty of this project, yes, it's distributed through PBS International. But really, what I'm getting the most joy out of, and I think is making a difference, is people around the country are doing screenings. And you can go to thestreetproject.com and look at how to host a screening in your community. And there, I'm mentioning that because I do this myself. If somebody asks me to go to a commission meeting, a committee meeting, a safety meeting, whatever, you want to have laws changed, passed, et cetera, I always feel like, well, I don't really know enough about that topic. I still feel that way about, you know, I'm not an urban planner to go to a meeting like that and really have anything to contribute. But what the film is a very safe way for people who are new to thinking about how we use our streets to go and watch a film. They don't have to speak. They don't have to contribute in any way. They can just go and watch a film. We all watch films. And then there'll be often there's a discussion afterwards with people who are leaders in the community, thought leaders on the topic. And then, you know, either they walk away deciding, maybe I'm going to adjust my lifestyle a little bit. Maybe I'd like to get involved a little bit more, or at least, hey, this is good to know. I'm, you know, whatever. So I think in that way, the idea is that if we can take leaders of the different communities who think about this all the time, get them to do showings in their community, in local cinemas, at the library, at schools, that sort of thing, and bring in people who don't normally think about this, then we're sort of inching our way. Along the way, when people are doing these screenings, if they can entice their local leaders to come to the screenings, who definitely most likely aren't really thinking about pedestrian and cycling issues in this way, get them to come, not necessarily participate, but at least come and watch the film, then maybe we have a little bit more of a fighting chance of making some progress.
Wouldn't that be nice?
And it, you know, it is happening. We so far we've been in. We're screening in Hawaii and Alaska and Provo, Utah, coming up soon. So we've been in almost 20. We've had 20 different states do screenings so far. I think we've had close to 50 screenings, but in communities since October. But anyway, so it's maybe, you know, a lot of these grassroots organizations can't afford to, you know, go out and get footage or film or whatever, or still photos to help highlight what their problems are in their community. So my hope is that at least this can be a tool for the grassroots work, the good work that they're already doing in their communities.
What's interesting is it doesn't matter the size of your community, that this could have useful information from a little incorporated township all the way through a place like New York City.
It is really true.
And I think that there's a lot of meat in there for that. Well, just a wonderful conversation. We've been speaking with Jennifer Boyd. She's the producer and director of The Street Project. It's thestreetproject.com. Yeah, host a screening in your community. I think you mentioned Bike Cleveland, I think.
Yes, and had screenings as well.
Yeah, yep. So Bike Cleveland is our advocacy organization here. You don't have to be an advocacy organization. Mm-hmm. I'm on a community engagement committee here in my community. So yeah, I love this idea, and I really appreciate you making the documentary and talking with me today.
Thank you for the work you're doing.
Oh, thanks. It's very rewarding work, especially when I get to do things like this.
Thank you.
Have a wonderful day.
Oh, you too.
All right. My thanks to Jennifer Boyd for joining me on the show today. If you'd like to find out more about the Street Project or book a screening, you can log on to thestreetproject.com. And you can find out more about Jennifer and her work at boydproductions.net. Let's take a short break, and when we return, we'll speak with custom frame builder Dave Wages. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm your host, Diane Jenks. The bicycle business has its biggies, the Treks, the Specialized, the Canyons, and then it has custom frame builders, such as Richard Sachs, Peter Weigel, and my guest, Dave Wages. Between those two bookends, there are companies such as Waterford Precision Bicycles and Cerata Custom Cycles. These were shops that could produce a frame to order within a few weeks and might have a small staff that could turn out upwards of several hundred to perhaps even 1,000 frames a year. But now those mid-sized custom shops are mostly gone. So I wanted to know what a builder who worked for shops like that and has since gone out on his own to produce his exquisite one-of-a-kind frame sets thinks about the situation as well as what he sees for the custom business going forward. Hi, Dave. Welcome back to The Outspoken Cyclist. It's been way too long since we last spoke, and I'm excited about catching up. How are you?
I'm doing great.
And you just got back from where? You just went on sort of a vacation.
We've done a couple of short trips. We were up in the Keweenaw Peninsula, up in Upper Michigan, and northern Wisconsin. We did some mountain biking. I've just in the last couple of years, my wife has gotten into mountain biking. And so it's kind of, you know, I've been rediscovering mountain biking a little bit as well, because I hadn't done it as much when she was not into it. So that's been kind of fun.
Yeah. Actually, it's interesting. I've heard other people talking about mountain biking more. I think access is better right now. There are more trails and more trails being built. When I talked to Imba, Dave Weens, you know, he's all about access, access, access. So that's pretty cool. I'm glad to hear that. And she as well, I take it. She looks healthy and fit.
Yeah, I think one of the big things that for her was finding trails that were accessible. From like a beginner standpoint, where, you know, a lot of the newer trails that are being built are these flow trails. And I know this is like a controversial topic with old school mountain bike guys, but flow trails are fun. Flow trails are a blast, and it makes it so much easier to get a beginner out on the trails and enjoy themselves.
Yeah, I think that's important. If you want somebody to get better, you better give them something they can handle to begin with, or you just discourage them, you know?
Definitely.
Right. Yeah. So let's just back up a little bit. And the last time we talked was, wow, many years ago, way longer yes. than I would have liked. But I want to know how things have changed since the last time we talked. We've been through a pandemic. We've been through the ups and downs of the industry, and you've done some great things. So how are things different from back when we spoke in either, you think it was 2012, I think you probably are right, which means it's more than 10 years. And now, how are things different for you and for the work you're doing?
One of the things that I felt like, you know, in thinking back to that time was, There were still like some niches that custom builders could fill. And I feel like the bike industry has found every niche possible and then completely inundated all those niches. I mean, obviously the most recent one being gravel bikes. I think before that, fat bikes, you know, everybody decided they had to have a fat bike. You know, when you went to Walmart and saw a Mongoose fat bike for $250, you knew, okay, we've reached full inundation level. So it just makes it more challenging, because I think, you know, the all roads bike and gravel bikes was one of the things that I jumped on fairly early on. And then just to see the industry come along and just the tidal wave of variations and, you know, everything, it just makes it tougher.
So that's an interesting point. And I think I've had this conversation with several other custom builders like yourself, that the industry tends to co-opt what custom builders are doing and bring it into their offerings, looking to you for innovation.
Yeah.
And then sort of turning that into, you know, a mainstream item, shall we say. So, yeah go ahead.
I get it. There's nothing wrong with that. You know, I'm certainly never going to be able to supply, you know, 20,000 units to the thousands and thousands of people that want to buy gravel bikes. But the flip side is, it's like you get lost in the noise a little bit with all the other offerings out there.
Well, that becomes another point. So I wasn't going to go down this road, but I think I will now, because you just opened it up. You just put the barrier away. And that is, and Brian and I have this conversation all the time, how, first of all, the material, steel, is not being requested, not being supported in a lot of ways. We lost True Temper not too terribly long ago. And then somebody, was it Nova, that picked up the lugs and tubing? And I mean, our part of the industry, this custom part of the industry, doesn't, and I hate to say that, because we're really not part of the industry per se. We are an independent group, and maybe that becomes the opening for a different way of looking at custom bikes. So how are you maintaining your business and growing it, given carbon fiber, stuff like through axles and disc brakes and all of these electronic shifting, none of which are horrible, but they've made it very challenging for custom builders?
Yeah, I think for me, it was always a matter of, when you see those new things coming out, you're like, you have to be very selective about what bandwagon you jump on. I will say that when electronic shifting came out, I jumped on that bandwagon pretty early on. I love it, and I'm still like a devotee to this day. I try to talk people into electronic shifting as much as I can, just because I love it so much. I get that it can be a little polarizing too, but I think a lot of times people are polarized about it because they've never experienced it and they don't understand the ins and outs of it. They think it's going to be like a cell phone where you have to charge it up every single day. And when you start to explain, like, hey, you know, you're going to have to charge this maybe like a couple of times a season, like, you know, then it becomes a little more accessible. And so less of a hurdle to get over.
Is that true? I thought that they needed to be charged more often. Maybe I am back at the beginning of DI2 and things have changed a lot more, but how often do you need to charge electronic shifting now?
It really depends. I mean, there's a couple of factors. Obviously, like, how much you shift is a big part of it. If you're shifting the front derailleur a lot more than the front derailleur uses more juice than the rear does. Obviously, like, when you've got different systems like SRAM versus Shimano, Shimano's got one dedicated battery that's running both front and rear. But my experience with Shimano is, you know, probably two or three times a season charging it up. And what it finally comes down to is, and you know, I have, both my wife and I have actually had rides this season where we ran out of juice on the ride, or we were getting ready to start a ride and you're like, oh, my battery's dead. And then you think back, you're like, well, when did I last charge this? It's like, oh, it's actually been kind of a long time.
Right.
So it's like you get in the habit of like, okay, if I've got a century coming up in like a super hilly area where I know I'm going to be shifting a ton, I should probably just throw it on the charger, even if it doesn't need it, and you're going to have no problem. So the beauty with SRAM is that they have little removable batteries, and so you can just carry an extra battery with you. Or because there's a battery on both derailleurs, you know, if the rear stops working, you can pop the one off the front and put it on there and get home. You know, because like how often do most of us really shift the front derailleur? So,
well, and now they're building one bys.
I know. I'm going to be checking out one by before too long here. So on my road bike, I've got some of that stuff coming. I'm really curious to see how I like this.
Let me take a moment to reintroduce you, and then I want to talk about a couple of other innovations that have happened since the last time we spoke. We're speaking with Dave Wages. He is the proprietor of and builder of Ellis Cycles, E-L-L-I-S. Excuse me. We will give you a way to track him down online before the end of our conversation. So I do want to talk about two other things, disc brakes on road bikes and through axles. So watching all of these stages of the Tour de France and people getting punctures, and the next thing you know, you do not change a tire in three or a wheel in 3 seconds anymore. And it's besides tubeless, which is also its own problems and situations, you can't get a quick release wheel off. What do you think about this, and how has it changed the way you're building frames?
I think it's just something that you have to deal with, because it's here, and like I could pitch a fit and complain about it, but it's not going to make it go away. All of the modern parts that you're going to buy, if you are going with disc brakes, disc, you have to do through axle. And so I've actually been doing through axle for quite a while now. I'm pretty pleased to say that I've figured out how to do steel forks with through axle and flat mount disc brakes. It's fairly tedious, so I do charge more for that. But if you want to run the modern parts and not have to like swap in like some older like post mount caliper or whatever, it really, and the nice thing for me is it allows me to build forks for bikes that need a custom fork. I just built a bike for a woman kind of local here who was riding an old Paramount with 650C wheels. It's very short. The 650C wheels worked great because they kind of proportionalized the bike down for her, but it's getting really, really hard to find 650C tires. And she's like, I'd love to have normal size wheels if I could do it, you know, 700C wheels. And so I built her a little bike with Shimano Ultegra DI2 and disc brakes. And I built a fork for it that had a lot of extra rake because she needed a fairly slack head angle, and we got the fit on it is beautiful for her, and it really makes me happy, especially seeing people who probably struggle to find a bike that fits them to get them on a bike that fits properly. So it's a little bit of a roundabout way of saying like I'm down with through axles and disc brakes. It may not be my favorite thing in the world. They add a level of complexity to building bikes, because in the olden days, if you had a wheel check that was a little bit out when you got done building a bike, you could grind the dropout a little bit. Now you have to like float the dropout in the seat stay or chain stay and actually like melt everything and like just shift it over a little bit, rebraze stuff up, re-clean it up. So it really forces you to be like super, super tight on all your tolerances. Everything's got to be exactly right to get that wheel in there straight.
Which is not a bad thing.
No, I mean, it definitely makes you up your game.
Right.
Yeah.
So besides this person who needed a small frame, and then at the other end of the spectrum, you have the person who needs an extremely large frame. Who is your client? How are they finding you? And what are they asking for? Are they asking for gravel, or are they asking for adventure? Are they asking? I mean, to me, gravel used to be called road sport, right? And used to be, oh, I'm going to throw a set of panniers on the back and turn it into, you know, lightweight, and turn it into a 3-day tripper bike. But what are they asking you for? What are you building mostly?
You know, probably the best way to describe it is a bike that can fit wider tires. And most often that is disc brake. But then where it goes from there can really depend. A lot of people want to have that flexibility of having wider tires, but then they end up running road wheels most of the time. And it's basically a road bike, but with some flexibility. But then you can do bikes where people want to do bike packing, where I'm adding mounts for frame bags, kind of accommodating for that, doing forks with mounts on the outside for carrying gear. So it's like there's like that middle point of like, I want a bike that can run wider tires and it's going to have disc brakes, but then it can go in so many different directions from there. It can go to like, I ride this on the road most of the time, to like a really extreme, you know, bike that I'm going to ride on the divide. So, and which is something my wife has it in mind. And so I've been noodling on what our divide bikes are going to look like.
I see. So we turned her from this novice mountain biker into, we're going to ride the divide. That's insane, Dave.
Well, she is never like one to shy away from a challenge. So okay. Yeah, she's the one who came up with the idea. She wanted to do a cross country tour. And so in 2018, she quit her job. And instead of doing the cross country tour from east to west, we did it from south to north, and we rode the Sierra Cascades route.
Oh, pretty.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. You could not ask for a more beautiful route, but you also could not ask for a hillier route. So every single day was pretty much hills.
And when you were done, you were so much stronger for it.
Yeah, I lost 25 pounds on that route.
Oh, I need to do that route.
I know. I need to go back and do it.
Right. Yeah, exactly. Oh, wait, we've been sitting. Which brings me to a question about the pandemic. How did you fare? I mean, here you are. You're still building bikes. What was happening for you during the pandemic? Also on the supply side, because, you know, of course, we all ran into that same issue of, oh, you can have a front derailleur, but you can't have a rear derailleur, or you can have a crank, but you can't have a bottom bracket, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I had enough business to keep me busy, but then I found I probably spent 6 times as much time as I usually did sourcing parts. So it was, okay, go to this supplier, then go to the second supplier, then go to the third supplier, and then try to like go, okay, what could I sub for this part? What could I do? And then, you know, at the end of the day, sometimes it was a matter of like, okay, I'm just going to go online and see if I can find one of these at retail because I need a shifter. And I've got a bike that's 95% built and I need a shifter so I can actually get paid. And so you pay retail for shifter. And it was, yeah, it just was like a constant like whack-a-mole trying to figure out,
great,
you know,
description.
where I'm going to find, you know, frankly, from a material standpoint for building frames, it wasn't that bad. I didn't have too much trouble finding materials for frames, but parts were just an absolute nightmare.
This just sounds exactly like our house.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, well, how much time did you spend online today? You know, yeah. And then ending up at something like Colorado Cyclist, you know, or Nashbar or whatever in the hell they call it now. Let's take a short break, and when we return, we'll speak with Dave some more. You're listening to The Outspoken Cyclist. We are back on The Outspoken Cyclist. I'm Diane Jenks, and my guest today is Dave Wages from Ellis Cycles. We pick up our conversation with Dave about the closing of Waterford in June. This is the little elephant, the baby elephant in the room. Richard Schwinn and Waterford. And of course, you and I have had our relationships with him over the years, and they're gone. What do you think about that? And who or how will that slack be picked up? Because not too many people were able to produce, say, a size run of frames, or, you know, the kinds of like the Gunner line, which we didn't do much with Gunner, but I know a lot of people who did. So what do you think it's going to do to the independent frame builder and to the marketplace? Is it going to like dry up more of the desire for steel again?
That's a really interesting question. You know, I have friends locally who heard about Waterford, you know, going out of business, and they know that I've worked there, and they're like, "Oh, you're going to be super busy now." I'm like,
right.
I'm not sure if that's like completely accurate. I have not seen like a huge rush of orders. I am working on a bike right now for a guy who had an S3 tube set he was hanging on to, True Temper S3 tube set. And he wanted to have Waterford build it. That was kind of in the back of his mind. And then like, once he found out that Waterford was closing up, it was kind of too late.
Right.
And he reached out to me and he was just like, "Do you know anybody else who welds?" And I'm like, "Well, I don't weld, but like, what do you need welded?" And he kind of, you know, we got into talking, and I'm like, "Well, I can certainly Phillip braze that." So I'm going to be building him a Phillip brazed S3 frame. So we actually, it was ironic. We met at the Waterford farewell ride, and he handed off the tube set to me there, which I don't know. It was a little surreal. I'm taking on work at the Waterford ride, but I can't say that I've had like a huge inundation of frame orders outside of that.
Do you think it's important that somebody fill that niche?
Yeah, it's a really, really hard niche to live in. You know, I worked at Cerata and Waterford. I don't know many other people that have worked at two of those kind of small to mid-size frame building companies, but it's like, it's probably the hardest place that you can inhabit in the bike industry. You're not small enough to be like super agile, or like, you know, be a one-man shop like me, where, you know, I don't have a bunch of employees that I have to do bookkeeping and, you know, pay for insurance and do all kinds of other stuff. Like, so, you know, I'm flexible in a way that they couldn't be, but then like, they don't have nearly the scale that a bigger company has. So it's not like when they call up, you know, the tubing manufacturers, they're like, "Oh, wow, let me put together this giant order for you. You know, this, you know, $4,000 order." They're not super concerned about that either. So it's frankly, I say this about both of those places, Cerata and Waterford. It's kind of amazing both of them lasted as long as they did, because it's just, it's a hard gig. And I don't think either one of them made tons and tons of money. Richard's not driving around in a Ferrari in his
retirement. No, he's not.
Yeah.
You'd have to know Richard. He might have a new violin, but he does not have a Ferrari, right?
No, definitely not.
Yeah, no, that's a really interesting point and well taken. You know, I think about who's left standing, and right now it's people like Firefly and Seven, but they're titanium.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Fat Chance is gone, Richard's gone, Ben's gone. Yeah,
did the new version of Fat Chance like fold up again?
Oh, I don't know.
Okay, because I know Chris was back.
Yeah, but he's on the West Coast now, right?
What?
He's on the West Coast now, right?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I don't know what the status is with him.
So the one who comes up for me, the one who comes to mind for me is Mike Varley at Black Mountain Cycle. But what he's doing is designing frames, having them built overseas, bringing them in, building them up, and shipping them out. So that's a completely different model. And you know, what people like you and Richard Sachs and Brian Chapman and Johnny Coast and all of those guys, Peter Weigel, are doing still seems to have some cachet with a portion of the population. The question is, how do we bring new people into that And how I mean, I don't know what the average age of your client is, but I know what it is of our client.
I think it's probably the same.
Old.
Oldish. Trending oldish. Older.
Trending older, that's good. So do you see that there is still value in a maybe a group marketing? Is there a way to explain to people how not exotic, but how desirable it is to have, it's like a custom suit. It's like going to Brooks Brothers and getting a custom suit, to have a bike built just for you. I mean, can you still sell that concept? Do you?
Yeah, I know it's difficult to figure out how to approach people. I think one of the dilemmas is now when people think of steel bikes, they're generally thinking of like Surly's, All Cities.
Right.
And they're like, they might even love, like, I meet a lot of people who are like, oh yeah, I have a Surly, I love it. And they're like, they have Surly's are great. Like, I think what they're doing is great. They're like super accessible bikes. You know, they do tons and tons of stuff, but it's almost a completely different thing than what I do. And so how you take somebody who maybe is like, I like steel because I have a Surly, and you explain to them like, okay, this bike has tubing that is way, way different than what your Surly has, and is built in this like one-off way. And here's what it costs, and here's why that's a value, is it's a tough sell. You know, I think like a lot of those folks that are riding Surly's and All Cities would probably be riding a carbon bike, but they just can't afford it, maybe. And so you get this like affection for the thing that you can afford. But it's not necessarily, there's not like this deep-seated thing. Like if I got a big raise at work, I'd go and buy a Specialized in a heartbeat. So I don't know. You know, that's the challenge for us. You know, I go out and I think a lot of it is just talking to people, you know, face to face, and having them meet people that have bikes of mine and rave about them. I have some great local folks who have gotten on bikes from a variety of backgrounds, and once they get the bike, they're like, oh man, this thing is really awesome. It makes a difference. It rides super smoothly. It fits me perfectly, you know. But I, you know, I'm not going to be able to put ads in Bicycling Magazine and reach, you know, hundreds of thousands of people. So,
well, and you also could not. So even if that were the case, even if we took, say, 20 builders and put together a really nice ad and put them up, if you suddenly had inquiries from 150 people at one time, you're like, oh, now I'm in trouble. That's a whole different way of looking at it. You know, then you need to be Waterford again or somebody like that.
Yeah, it's tricky, you know, because if you're sitting there answering the phone all day long, that doesn't work either. I'm doing the whole enchilada. And how do you get people comfortable enough with you to give you money sight unseen of the thing that they're going to buy too?
So true. So do you ever go to events like maybe a gravel race and take a couple of bikes and let people try them? Is that something you've done or thought about?
You know, I don't have a couple extra bikes for them to try. Like if they're big and tall, they can ride one of my bikes. They could ride my wife's bike for a short period of time. She has a nice, like average sized bike, but I don't have like a fleet of gravel bikes that I can bring to these events. You know, that's almost cost prohibitive for me right there.
Right.
So I go to events and I try to talk to as many people as want to hear about Ellis. You know, both my wife and I wear our Ellis kits, you know, and we're ambassadors, and my wife is probably more outgoing than I am. I'm a little reticent because I don't want to seem like I'm tooting my own horn too much. She's a lot better. She's my wingman. She kind of talks me up. And then like, if people are interested and they want to talk, you know, technical stuff, then I can definitely do that. But I think a lot of people look at the bikes and they're like, oh, how old is that? Like, that's an old bike, right?
So funny that you say that. Brian was doing one of the Hincapie Grand Fondos, riding at that time. He was riding Waterford, I don't remember. It's all I can tell you is it's beautiful pumpkin orange or dark orange. And he loves the bike. Goes by somebody going downhill at, like, you know, he's a demon descender. And the guy's going, wow, that's really a nice old classic bike. And he's thinking, I just built this last year.
Right.
It's crazy. That's what people see when they see, you know, these polished lugs and, you know, thin tubing. And yeah, I know. Let me ask you a question about sustainability and about the problems that carbon fiber will leave behind, because it isn't a renewable source like steel is. You can always, you know, melt down steel and do something else with it or whatever, you know, it'll rust in place and go away. Do you think there's a generation of perhaps riders now and in the future who would look at that and say, maybe carbon fiber isn't the right material for the way I think and the way I want to live my life right now? Is that a possibility?
Interesting. I guess I hadn't thought about coming at it from that direction. I think, like, for the typical client that might consider one of my bikes, I don't think that's a big concern of theirs.
Too, like, bad, without, right?
Yeah, I mean, like, I think unfortunately, like, the younger people that are actually thinking that way are probably not in a position to buy a bike for me necessarily.
Right.
I hate to, like, stereotype like that. I mean, I certainly have sold bikes to you know, people in their 30s, you know, and I love it. And they're generally very happy with the bikes. And I think they might be thinking more in that vein, but I think, like, in general, probably not as much.
Yeah. Too bad. I mean, I've seen a lot of our older customers who have bikes that we've built over the years go out and buy a new Trek or a new Specialized, and they love the bikes. There's no question that they love these carbon fiber bikes. They're light, they're fast. Pinarello is another one. But if you can afford a $15,000, $18,000 Pinarello, it's strange to me that that's what you'd want to buy when you could get something built by you or Brian or somebody like that. But that is the market today. So the last thing I want to talk about is how people can find out more about you and your work and see what you're doing.
So people can definitely just get on the phone and give me a call. My phone number's on my website. They can definitely check out my website, which is www.elliscycles.com. They can follow me on Facebook. I have both an Ellis Cycles and a Dave Wages page, although I will say I probably post more stuff on the David Wages page. So that's probably the easier one to follow and check out bikes, current builds. I have an Instagram as well. That's Ellis Cycles. So I try to keep those updated, keep people, you know, apprised of what's going on, new bikes that are coming out. Yeah, that's the best thing. And if people have questions, like, I'm always happy to chat with people on the phone and just answer questions. And, like, again, that's a huge part of what this process is. You know, it is all the conversations that you have before I ever even think about pulling a tube out of the drawer or picking up a file or a hacksaw, is making sure that we're on the same page and that I'm building you exactly the right thing that you've got in mind before any of that stuff starts.
How has social media impacted your business? Has it helped?
It certainly hasn't hurt. I mean, it just gives you, I can have somebody, you know, on the other side of the world that's following my stuff and, you know, scrolling through and sees a picture that I post 30 seconds after I post it, you know, and when Richard Sachs and Ben Serrata were starting out, like, they didn't have anything like that. Right. They had to rely on, like, okay, I got to sell some bikes to some local guys, and then hopefully more people will see these local guys. And so it's a completely different world than that.
Well, this has been such a great conversation. I love talking with you, and you know, another Midwest builder. And so we've been speaking with Dave Wages from Ellis, E-L-L-I-S Cycles. If you want to know the story of how the name came about, which I read again just yesterday, it's a great story. And I hope you have a great summer. Don't get too hot. Don't get too dehydrated. And don't... I mean, really, this is, climate change is going to make a difference, I think, in our business too.
I know. Thankfully, I think being near the Great Lakes is going to be helpful.
I agree. Fresh water.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Dave. Have a wonderful summer.
It was nice chatting with you.
Take care.
Okay.
My thanks to Dave for joining me today. I hope you enjoyed our conversation as much as I did. You can find out more about Dave and his work at ellis cycles.com. My thanks to you for listening, and I hope you enjoyed the show. Here we are midsummer, and hopefully you've been taking advantage of good riding weather. As we approach fall, the Outspoken Cyclist will be ramping up the show again with some great new guests. So please remember to subscribe to the podcast so that you never miss an episode. You can follow us on Instagram and X, Twitter, aka Twitter, yes, X, and on Facebook. Show notes, photos, and links are always available on our website, outspokencyclist.com, and you're free to leave a comment there too. So I hope you have a great day. Stay safe, stay well, and remember, there is always time for a ride. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on The Outspoken Cyclist with Diane Jenks. We welcome your thoughts and contributions on our Facebook page, or visit OutspokenCyclist.com to leave a comment on any episode. We will be back next week with new guests, topics, conversations, and news from the world of cycling. Subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast app and you'll never miss an episode. The Outspoken Cyclist is a copyrighted production of DBL Promotions with the assistance of WJCU-FM Cleveland, a service of John Carroll University. Thanks again for listening, ride safely, and we'll see you next week.